That has to be at least like about 150 miles out that you can see.
From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional.
Are we over Hollywood right now? Yeah. Hollywood. It's very inspiring looking. If you want opportunity, this is the land of opportunity. You gotta apply yourself. So if there's something you wanna do in life, you just gotta go get it. The view is amazing. You can see all the way from East LA all the way to the Hollywood Hills.
Unfictional is a program of stories and personal documentaries told like a journey. Radio movies, secret histories.
Oh, I guess this worked out.
Well, as far as I can tell, I'm at the Mulholland Drive overlook.
It's at the apex of a very sharp curve on Mulholland Drive in the hills above the Hollywood Bowl.
I'm looking at downtown Los Angeles out in the distance. Nice big sprawl, a lot bigger than I pictured it.
And on a clear day, it's where tourists come to look at the view.
We just landed this morning, and we can see the Pacific Ocean over there. They said because it's such a clear day.
I'll give it an A. This is an A+, actually. This is a really beautiful view.
Want to get ideas about your music or whatever? Just come up here. You'll find yourself. It's very amazing.
When I was younger, it would come more than 100 times a year. For a kid, no playing outside, just stay in the house. A brown band of dirt would hang in the air over the city. But they always said the most hazardous chemicals were the ones you couldn't see. Have a nice day. But then it would rain. The sky was rinsed. The air felt clean. It looked clear. You could see snow in the San Gabriel Mountains, skyriders over the beach. After a good rain, my father would look out the car window and tell me, the postcard photographers are all going to be out today.
Blue sky. As far as the eye can see, a few fluffy little clouds in the distance, but very clear, very crisp.
There hasn't been a stage one smog warning in years and years. You know, everybody drives a Prius now. The history of Southern California is always woven through with legend, secrets, and rumors. On this episode, producer Eric Allen takes you on a hypnotic trip through LA's back pages of history, from the day smog arrived in town to the bombardment of Elwood, the first shelling of the U.S. mainland in World War II, all because of some hurt feelings and a prickly pear cactus. The Bay of Smokes. It's Unfictional on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
From KCRW, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Today on the program, a story from producer Eric Allen, and longtime Unfictional listeners may remember the story he did about the LA gangster Mickey Cohen, and how his excessive hand-washing helped him avoid getting whacked. That's the kind of story Eric does, part history, part dream, part hallucination. It seems like it can't possibly be true, but somehow it is. From KCRW, it's Unfictional, and The Bay of Smokes.
It's been about 9 years since we moved into our West Hollywood apartment, and there's only one air conditioner. It's in the living room, and we don't use it much because it's not very good, and it certainly doesn't reach the bedrooms, and it's so loud that you can't hear the TV when the AC is running. That's why when a heat wave settles upon Los Angeles, we leave it off and open all the windows at night to reel in the cool air rolling east off the Pacific. Now, in my daughter's bedroom, there's one window crank that's never worked. It won't turn all the way and open the window. And her ceiling fan just pushes around hot air. The day's heat stays trapped well past evening. I mean, all right, like, that makes it sound more torturous than it really is. It gets sweaty in there, but she sleeps fine. I'm only bringing it up because of why I let it stay broken. It was worth it to lie to my wife about trying to get the maintenance guys to fix it because I didn't want it fixed, and I never gave the reason why a second thought. Until I came across this story about smog. Did you know that smog just showed up one day in Los Angeles on July 8th, 1943, like an uninvited guest or a stranded hitchhiker? It was just a random Thursday morning during a hot stretch of days, and it was too late by the time everyone got up because by dawn, the whole downtown area was fogged in and visibility was cut to just a few city blocks. It felt sudden to everyone who encountered the fumes. They were crying, coughing, sneezing, wondering who was doing this to them. And that's what bothered me, how dumbfounded they were. I mean, what caused that gas attack is not a mystery to us, but it was a mystery to them. I'm not saying that was the first hazy day, you know, all the way back to 1542, Southern California has had a reputation for haze. That's when the explorer Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo sailed into what's now San Pedro, and he saw a low fog of smoke from locals doing controlled burns, and in his diary, he called the place Bahia de las Fumas, or the Bay of Smokes. So, the Los Angeles area has been hazy, at least occasionally, ever since it's been inhabited. But this attack of fumes was something new. This was the first time that perfect weather conditions combined with just enough emissions from just enough cars and trucks on the road, and the whole mix got baked over the valleys, trapped in a bottleneck created by the mountains to the north, east, and south. The summer sun cooking up an ozone layer of pollution that finally spilled into view. Smog. When smog is new, it's confusing. A hovering smoke with no fire. And those trapped downtown were looking to the sky and not recognizing the black fog for what it was. They didn't recognize their future. Kate Den Bell was the firstborn child of an Irish pioneer. She could see the future because she knew where oil was, but even she couldn't foresee the consequences of pulling it out of the ground, of refining and burning it and releasing its tiny particulates into the atmosphere. Kate viewed the California skies as part of her birthright. Her father was a 19th century land baron who owned huge chunks of California's raw coast, and she inherited a worthy share near modern-day Goleta, just north of Santa Barbara. Kate made a bold prediction on her 76th birthday. It was 1920, and she called together her whole family to celebrate. The party was a camp out on the beach at the mouth of a canyon that still bears her name. Bell Canyon. And on the final day of the festivities, the actual day of Kate's birthday, she's holding court and motions for her gathered clan to notice a small prickly pear cactus clinging to a dune. It was the only cactus nearby, and she said,
"If you drill an oil well where the cactus grows, you will strike a gusher. Mark my words well, for they will make you rich one day."
No one laughed, but no one paid it much mind. And Kate died a few years later. Her parcel of paradise was divided up by her children, and Kate's daughter, Caroline, inherited Bell Canyon, and with it, the dunes surrounding her mother's cactus. A few years later, Caroline recalled her mother's prophecy when a young geologist sought a lease to drill for oil on her land. He drilled right next to Kate's prickly pear cactus. The well was drilled deeper than anyone in the territory had gone before, and it hit the mother lode. Oil Well was called the Luton Bell Number 1, and it was such a massive gusher that it drew everyone else into the Santa Barbara Channel. In the late 1920s, an explosion of activity and prosperity fell upon Bell family land. But as more and more equipment flooded onto the beach property, Caroline's husband noticed something. The trucks and tractors were getting too close to his mother-in-law's cactus, which by now had grown into a small patch. So he had a welded iron fence built around it to protect it. And even today, you can visit the same beach, topped by a golf course now instead of an oil well, and that cactus patch climbs up the hill, and no amount of fence could contain it. And all across California, the oil wells help bring about smog. And yeah, Kate, California never had smog. She never had to deal with it. But we do. Los Angeles is now synonymous with smog. And that's why I wanted my daughter's window to stay broken. If it didn't open, then smog would have trouble sliding in and mixing with her breathing while she was sleeping. That broken crank acting as a bulwark. But that kind of reasoning evaporates under the heat of focused examination. What about the open window in our bedroom, right next to hers? The air spreads through the whole apartment. It doesn't make any sense. But as a parent, I don't care. You make a constant string of decisions based on some protective instinct that could be the totally wrong thing to do, but a new string of decisions comes along needing attention before the old ones can be fully examined. The first few hours of July 8th, 1943, were disorienting for those stuck downtown in the smog. Some worried it was sinister. Maybe it was another Jap attack, they asked each other. Everyone was still on edge because of an attack off the Santa Barbara coast the year before. A Japanese submarine under the command of Kozo Nishino had surfaced off the shore of Kate's Cactus and started firing shells at the beach. An oil rigger who witnessed the submarine attack told a local paper,
"It was a mile offshore. I could see it very clearly. It was so big, I thought it might be a destroyer or a cruiser. There were a couple horses in the pasture near where I watched the shelling. The shells were exploding, and the horses screamed and raced about."
Hilda Wheeler, who was running the Wheeler Inn at the time, told a newspaper reporter,
"The Japanese gunners realized they were missing their marks, so raised their gun, and now the shells went whizzing over the cliffs and incidentally over our heads. Well, by that time, the army had taken over. The blackout signals wailed their warning. The coast was in complete darkness. The president's speech was over. In fact, the radio stations were silent."
"By order of the Coast Interceptor Command, this station will now leave the air. Put out your lights. This station will now leave the air."
"We all felt sort of tired after the excitement, so we went inside where the only light came from the flame under the coffee urn. We sat and just talked about what had happened and what might have happened."
What Hilda and the town realized the next morning was that not much had happened. There were over a dozen shells fired towards the oil wells, but Kozo didn't hit a damn thing, except he blew a wooden pier to bits. He missed the giant oil storage tanks that would have made terrifying explosions. But maybe he wasn't aiming for the tanks. Maybe he was aiming at something harder to hit. Local legend claims the attack was an act of revenge. You see, as a captain aboard Japanese oil tankers in the 1930s, Kozo made numerous trips to this exact oil field. During one visit, when Kozo was invited on shore by the oil company for a ceremony, and he was making his way along the dunes with his crew and some of the oil company executives in tow, and he somehow managed to fall over the welded iron fence, falling tail over tea kettle into Kate's patch of prickly pear cactus. The hosts were as embarrassed as the Japanese guests, but a trio of nearby oil riggers thought it was fucking hilarious. They were laughing loudly at the spectacle of an officer getting cactus spines brushed off his backside. Well, that mocking laughter must have stung, because Kozo left the ceremony in a polite but grim mood. During his submarine attack, Kozo radioed his commanding officers that Santa Barbara was left in a seething mass of flames with wild panic visible on shore. And on Radio Tokyo, the Japanese military called it a devastating attack on the American mainland. But within months, Kozo was relieved of his command, and he evaporates into the mist of history and disappears from view. The residents of Bell Canyon were scared. Pearl Harbor was fresh in their minds. But they were not as devastated as Radio Tokyo claimed. However, over a year later, the headlines still showed that residents were grappling with their fears about this new enemy, Japan. The front page of the Los Angeles Times was still stoking those fears on that first smoggy morning, 17 months after that submarine attack, July 8th, 1943. And one headline declared, "Disloyal Japs, soon to be segregated." The story detailed a special prison camp being built to hold captive any Japanese citizen who refused to take a loyalty oath. But right below that story, on that same front page, another headline declared, "Plans finished for network of 13 freeways." That story was an update on the city's final plans to construct a network of freeways across the city. Some of the coughing Angelenos were holding that morning edition of the Times, telling them about prison camps for Japanese alongside a 30-year plan promising easy freeway access for all their cars and trucks. The map from that article shows more freeways than ever really got built, but the ones we have now are all on there. The big ones we call the 10, the 101, and the 405. They form a ring around my neighborhood in West Hollywood. It's harder to be more central, yet farther away from a freeway on-ramp than my apartment near the Sunset Strip. And I'd been telling myself that being farther away from the freeways was better for my family, less pollution. As if the amount of difference in exposure was enough to actually matter, but it doesn't, does it? There's not less danger with a broken window as a bulwark and a ring of freeways as a private moat. So I told my landlord to fix the window. A few Japanese Americans had predicted that submarine attack on Bell Canyon. They also said that Los Angeles would be attacked the next night. What happened instead became known as the Battle of Los Angeles. This was early in the dark morning of February 25th, 1942, less than 48 hours after Kozo stumbled through the Santa Barbara Channel. And word of an impending attack swept all the radio stations off the air again, ushering in another blackout order for the entire area. The Air Force reported something strange over the coast. Searchlights swept the sky, and sirens wailed. A slow-moving object was seen by some in the intensity of the bright patch where a score of searchlights converged high in the air. The first spotlight beams had barely joined together before anti-aircraft batteries exploded their shells against the night sky. The huge guns were targeting that bright focal point of converged spotlights joined together like fingers on a Ouija board directing a planchette. The reports varied widely. Shrapnel bursting over and over awoke the entire city, and people wandered out in their pajamas. Streets dark from the blackout, and they stared at the sky, watching the barrage. Some spectators swore that they saw planes. Some called it a cloud-like formation. But observers with binoculars were unable to see anything but smoke and sky. Blanche Sedgwick was staying on West 43rd Place near Culver City. She was sleeping in a guest bedroom before she stepped outside onto the porch to see what was happening. She saw the flashes and heard the explosions, and high above her, an unexploded anti-aircraft shell whistled towards the driveway, tagging a telephone wire on the way down and exploding, shattering windows, and fragments of the shell pierced her bedroom wall and tore through Blanche's mattress and blanket, which must have still been warm from her body. I don't know where she slept the rest of the night. Maybe she didn't. But by 7:21 a.m., the all-clear signal was given, triggering the worst traffic jam in the city's history, as all the idle cars were free to move about together in the morning sun. Spending over a year at war, waiting to be attacked, the skies could fill with enemies. That was all wrapped up in how Angelinos reacted to that first smoggy July morning. But after an hour or so, it became obvious the fumes were not a Japanese gas attack. People were coughing, but they weren't dying. So even the most paranoid among them had to wonder who was to blame. The front page of the Los Angeles Times, a few days after this smog attack, barely mentions it. Below the fold, a small headline announced, "Heavy gas fumes in air, blamed for smarting eyes." But the rest of the front page was mostly concerned with news of the Allied attack on Sicily.
"The invasion of Sicily came in the 200th week of the war. No one here is underestimating the magnitude of the task confronting the American, Canadian, and British troops. They are attempting something that has never been done before. Our command of the air is complete."
And all through the summer, more smog attacks rolled in and just as quickly rolled out. Superior Judge Roy V. Rhodes was assigned to a City Hall Tower courtroom, and he said the fumes were so bad that he refused to conduct sessions until relief was gained. And Mayor Bowerin, he promised to solve the issue in 4 months. He opened a grand jury investigation to get to the bottom of this great mystery. After much deliberating and testing, the culprit was determined. There was a butadiene plant near the Los Angeles River, just east of downtown, and it was run by the Southern California Gas Company, but had been pumping out black rubber for the war effort. The thick, greasy fumes from the smokestacks became the prime suspect. Shutting it down was hard, though, because the military needed it. But that's how badly the mayor wanted to solve this problem. They finally shut it down, and of course, the smog came right back. And on the top floors of City Hall, there are no longer any courtroom sessions. But in one of those hallways, a portrait of every Los Angeles mayor graces the walls. And the portrait of Mayor Bowerin looks out a window, staring at the distant mountains. And to me, his oil-painted gaze looks like it's still searching that horizon for a culprit. And all the smog days have run together. And it's still not fixed. Like my window. After I told my landlord the window was busted, two guys came to look at it. They made a note, they took a picture, and then nothing. They won't get back to me on it. So the window's still broken, but at least now I want it fixed.
That was The Bay of Smokes by Eric Allen. He's a video producer at the Huntington Library. It was edited by Nick White. We had production help on this episode from Devin Schwartz, who recorded the interviews up at the Mulholland Overlook. We heard from Jesse Prather, Billy Hesketh, Jade Blaylark, Daniela Beninati, and Chloe Miller. Find Unfictional at Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and give the show a nice review if you like it. You can find the past archives of the program at kcrw.com/unfictional. I'm Bob Carlson, the producer of the program. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. The theme music is by Alex Weston. Music help from Joe Augustine and Narrative Music. On the next episode of the program, a tiny tourist spot clinging to the side of the California coast is isolated by a bridge collapse and a mudslide and cut off from all visitors. But turns out they're totally fine with it. We sent two reporters in on a secret road to visit a town that's been set back to the 1960s. I'm Bob Carlson. Please join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.